It's one thing to know who you are, know what your strengths are, know what you're motivated by, what you're passionate about, and what you want to do. But if that doesn't have a context, an ecosystem, a community to exist in, you're not necessarily going to get the pleasant emotion that's associated with it, right? So I think it's a really this kind of nice combination of me and we, right? These me needs and these we needs, and finding ways for those to fit together.
Hello and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. Today we welcome Dr. Nick Holton to the show. Nick is an international speaker, consultant, trainer, and coach. His work focuses on helping individuals become better versions of themselves through the application of the cutting-edge science of human flourishing, a synergistic development of both peak performance and overall well-being and fulfillment. He works with individuals, teams, businesses, and organizations ranging from professional athletes, NCAA programs, educational institutions, first responders, and Fortune 100 executives. He is co-founder of the Anti-Fragile Academy, and he also hosts the podcast Flourish FM, which is sponsored by the Human Flourishing Program at Harvard and the Department of Education at Oxford. Nick has worked with clients, given talks, and delivered trainings across the US, Europe, India, Australia, Uganda, Singapore, Mexico, and South America. In this episode, I talked to Nick Holton about human flourishing. Our current education system is primarily concerned with teaching academic subjects. While building knowledge is essential, this is not enough to allow students to self-actualize. Nick points out that young people's need to matter should be addressed as well. To facilitate human flourishing, we need to embed the different principles of positive psychology both inside and outside of the classrooms. Nick and I believe that education can transform society for the better, and we exchange ideas on how we can build an ecosystem that fosters holistic development. This is a topic really near and dear to my heart, and it was great to have this chat with someone who I really admire. Nick's a great guy, he's super smart, super caring, and he has a really amazing go-get-em attitude. So without further ado, I bring you Dr. Nick Holton.
Hey buddy, how you doing?
Good man, it's good to see you.
It's so good to see you too. Oh boy. Well, I'm really looking forward to chatting with you today, and thank you so much for being on my podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I've been looking forward to this as well. It's nice to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you too. I'd love for you to introduce yourself to our audience a little bit, because you are many things, as we all are, but you're many unique things.
Well, I appreciate that. I don't know how unique they are, but Dr. Nick Holton. So as I tell people, I really focus on, I think, the science of human flourishing and sort of the three E's. So that's entrepreneurs and execs, elite athletes, and as we'll probably talk about a little bit today, education or educators as well. So my PhD is in educational psychology. I'm traditionally an educator, trained as an educator, but have moved sort of into the world of, you know, our scientific understanding of human flourishing and the good life.
Okay, so you are interested in the science. What was your training?
My training is in educational psychology, so primarily focused on research and application of educational principles, pedagogical principles, psychological principles in educational spaces. You could interpret educational spaces rather broadly, but in this particular degree, it was focused on classroom experiences and school experiences, and I've just taken some of those and transferred them to other contexts.
Okay. When you studied educational psychology, when you studied education, did you bring in, were there some favorite theories in the field of psychology that you brought into your work? This is the psychology podcast. So let's integrate, psychology into this. You know, were there certain things you're like, wow, like I really love that psychologist and how they were thinking about education?
Yeah. And it's not even necessarily the way they were thinking about education, because I think part of what I found is that I didn't necessarily come across a researcher or researchers that were thinking about education in the big picture in the way that I really wanted to or thought we should. We'll probably talk about and reference Ken Robinson, Sir Ken Robinson, the late great Sir Ken Robinson, who I know you're a big fan of. There were people like that, just not necessarily folks I would qualify as academic researchers. The closest people I would come to are, of course, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi and Richard, Ryan, and Ed Deasy.
Yeah.
So my introduction was basically coming through a master's program, teaching for a long time, looking at the situation around me and saying, this ain't it. This is not as good as it gets, despite being in a context where it could have probably been about as good as it gets, if you remove that context from the educational system. And so when I entered my PhD program, I really went searching, not just for research, but really for examples and understanding of how we could do this better. Because I was looking at young people who were, you know, who found their element, so to speak, right? Who were passionate, who were excited, who weren't just jumping through the hoops and chasing grades and admission to certain schools and those sorts of things. And the closest thing I came to were D.C. Ryan, intrinsic motivation, passion, purpose, flow, those sorts of things. And that eventually opened me up to the world of positive psychology and flourishing more generally.
Awesome. So when was your introduction into the field of positive psychology?
So I started finding and then studying and writing about eudaimonia or eudaimonia, depending on how you want to pronounce it. It must have been 2012. It was pretty early into my doctoral program. That opened me up to sort of these different versions and scientific conceptualizations of well-being. And that eventually led me down the road to sort of just reading different things that have, and then as fate would have it, in 2014, 2015, it must have been 2015, it was the graduating class of 2015, the school I was working at brought in Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar. And so I was mid-dissertation, writing a lot about sort of the science of well-being, eudaimonia, engagement, intrinsic motivation, flow, and then here comes Tal. And if your listeners don't know Tal, Tal started the positive psychology program at Harvard that became wildly popular. And I think in many ways was sort of on the front line of the development of this field. I was very fortunate. I went up and introduced myself. He was incredibly kind. He offered to read my dissertation. He was very supportive, offered to help in any way he could. So that only kind of furthered my deep dive and enthusiasm into the field as a whole. And it evolved from there.
That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah. He's a prior guest of our podcast as well.
I would imagine. Yeah. He's a great guy. Great guy.
Yeah. 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 Absolutely. Okay. So when did you get into coaching and consulting? Because you've worked with professional and collegiate athletes, Fortune 500 business leaders, obviously educators, but also thought leaders from around the world. It's in your bio. Yeah. So can you, when did that happen? So that's like an add-on to your career, right?
Yeah. Well, in some ways, yeah. I mean, to the coaching question depends on how you want to frame up coaching. I had been coaching soccer for a decade already. By the time I entered my doctoral program, it was my gig in college during undergrad, right? I was a pretty good player myself and knew I wanted to go into education, knew I wanted to work with young people. And so coaching the sport that I played seemed like a nice natural transition, right? So I have in some way, shape, or form been instructing, coaching, teaching, whatever you want to call it, you know, whatever semantic debate you want to have around those terms, really since 2003, probably. Right. So 15 years or so in each field, you know, combined 30 years experience across basically every age group and most, I think, probably different demographic populations as well. So there was a lot of coaching, a lot of teaching from 2003 to really within the last few years, handful of years, probably like once I defended my dissertation, 2016. I started my own business, started coaching, started consulting, because I basically looked at what I was doing inside a classroom around flourishing, pause psych, wellness, motivation, purpose, you know, a lot of the stuff that you write about in Transcend as well, and said, well, this can apply to anybody, right? Like, it's great to be able to sit here and do this with young people, but I can do more and I want to do more. So that turned eventually into adult courses. So I was teaching a lot of parents of the school that I worked at. I was teaching a lot of alumni. And then I started kind of as a side gig advising some business leaders, working with athletes here and there. And then it just sort of developed to the point where, and then eventually you and I met this way. Eventually I left that school, moved to Philadelphia, your original hood, and was kind of walking around downtown. In fact, I remember it very specifically. Walking around downtown, Washington Square Park, listening to your episode with Glenn Fox on FRC Radio.
That's funny.
So I had followed Stephen Kotler, we're talking about, for a while, and had been a fan. And I listened to that episode. I knew you already, not personally, but I knew of you. Mm-hmm. Went back and left, I think, a comment on social media somewhere and just said, hey, great episode. Really enjoyed it. And then the CEO of Flow Research Collective reached out, said, hey, it looks like you're doing a lot of this sort of work already. Why don't you come coach for us? And that led to, I think, my sort of official entry into formal coaching, if you will, right? And then you and I met, and I've been doing mostly that work for the last couple of years.
Got some intel from Full Research Collective that you're killing it over there.
Well, that's very nice. I'm happy to hear that.
I recently was talking to someone very high up over there who said, I said, who's your favorite coach over the, well, I shouldn't say that, but just off the record. Yeah.
Appreciate it.
I asked them who their favorite coach was, and they said you.
Okay, awesome. Well, we have a slate of tremendous coaches, but I'm glad to hear that. I feel like it's a good fit, and I hope I add value not only to that organization, but to the people who come through it.
Absolutely. So look, there are so many mutual areas of overlap of interest between us. It makes it a bit overwhelming in order to think where does one begin in our discussion. Well, one could start with the coaching more broadly, education more specifically. I would really love to combine these two things because it's something that's just been on my heart lately, is this idea of I would love to be able to train teachers to be self-actualization coaches, you know, mm-hmm. And I know that's an idea that really resonated with you too. What do you think are some of the main sort of principles or things you've learned from your coaching experience that you think we can apply in schools to help bring out the best in students? I think that'd be a good way to kind of start kick off our discussion.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to do this in sort of in levels, and like you said, we have a lot of areas, I think, of mutual interest and probably mutual agreement to a certain extent as well. The idea that there should be a universal approach is not just problematic, but actually harmful in many cases.
Yeah.
But when I'm working with a client, a student, whoever it might be, the educational term is differentiation. And I think you have a very personal experience with this as well, given your time as a kid in school and going through the system, to be able to look at each young person or adult for who they are, what their situation is, what their context is, and then start to work and develop a plan from there. Now, the tricky part there, of course, is plan for what? There's a larger systemic question involved in that, right? But it starts with, I think, having the time and the space to be able to get to know each person you're working with on a deeper one-to-one level, right? Which typically is not the case in a lot of classrooms these days.
So do you think personalized attention is a key part of what's so valuable about the coaching process? Is that what I'm hearing from what you're saying?
100%.
100%. So, Cool. Yeah, there is something really special there. No, you're right. And I think we should, as Angela Duckworth says, let's double click on that. I think that to be able to feel as though you matter, you know, that your individual existence matters in an education environment would be huge. And I think that coaching and being that one-on-one attention signals that in a way, right? Do you see that need for mattering as playing a big role in the work you do?
100%. Yeah, I mean, it makes me think of your book, right? And these different ways to access meaning. And I'd be really interested in having a deep conversation with developmental psychologists on this, because if we're just talking about young people, so we had an interview with Lee Waters a couple of months ago. Yeah, I know you know Lee. We both love Lee. She's terrific. And we were talking to her a bit about her Visible Wellbeing program and the different sort of components of it. And myself and my co-host for our podcast kind of pressed her a little bit on the purpose and meaning question. Said, where is it? Where is it in your framework? Where is it in your model? And she made the argument that in their very large scale studies, you often don't see that need, or at least have meaning and purpose come to sort of the top of the list for people at that age. On some level, that makes sense. And I think it actually is a good pushback against what I just said about personalized attention, because I don't want personalized attention to sound like everyone should just do whatever they want, because we need to learn to live in community and groups and ecosystems and all those sorts of things. So on the one hand, you know, I'm taking that very good research from somebody I deeply respect, right? And at the same time, looking at the, if you will, anecdata, right? This term I keep hearing getting thrown around. All people want to matter, but it seems to me that young people especially are really driven to find someone or something that gives them that sense of mattering. It might not be purpose, but it's some level of probably, you know, the boat, you know, self-esteem, connection, relationships. I matter to someone or something, right? So I think there's, it's not really an either or. I think there's room for a both and yeah, 100% young people are looking for that. I think that is the crux of what we're getting into in the world of education is, I think a lot of young people feel like they matter to the extent that they can get the grades, get the test scores, get into the schools and go get the job. Mm. Right. And
yeah, you're right.
People know, like, the system primarily is designed for that. Well, what about the hundreds of thousands of kids, right, year after year, for whom that path and that trajectory and that skill set, right, propensity doesn't fit? How do we help them matter, right? How do we find ways and channels to kind of pull that out of them, to help them become more aware of that, and then execute it on a way that creates that sense of mattering for themselves, rather than having it kind of just be up to what the system dictates?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's a good question. How do we? How do we? I am so excited to announce that registrations are now open for our self-actualization coaching intensive. While the coaching industry has taken great strides over the years toward integrating more evidence-based coaching approaches, there is still a lot of work to be done. Many coach training programs still lack strong foundations in science and do little to incorporate research-informed tools, methodologies, or approaches for helping clients thrive. For 20 years, I've dedicated my career to rigorously testing ways to unlock creativity, intelligence, and our potential as human beings. Now, for the first time ever, I have compiled some of my greatest insights to bring the new science of self-actualization to the field of professional coaching. This immersive 3-day learning experience will introduce you to self-actualization coaching, an approach intended to enhance your coaching practice by offering you evidence-based tools and insights from my research that will equip you to more effectively help your clients unlock their unique potential. Self-actualization coaching is a whole-person approach to coaching that aims to help the client find their most alive and creative center of being, connect deeply with themselves, and become who they truly want to become. Grounded in the foundational principles of humanistic psychology, self-actualization coaching also draws from the latest psychological science, including the fields of positive psychology, coaching psychology, developmental psychology, personality psychology, neuroscience, and the science of creativity. Don't miss out on this unique opportunity. Join us and take your coaching practice to the next level. Register today and get 20% off. Don't miss out on this very special event. Go to sacoaching.org. That's sacoaching.org and get 20% off today. I look forward to welcoming you in December. It has long occurred to me that we need to do something different about how we handle troublemakers. You know, that's something that that occurred to me as you were talking, and not just help the ones who are already succeed more. You know, but we do a terrible job handling the troublemakers, don't we? And we completely neglect the fact that they may have a lot of creative potential. And because, you know, they're defiant, or let's say they're rebellious. Well, rebelliousness is not necessarily a bad characteristic,
right,
if integrated and harnessed in a good way. So what role do you see in coaching young kids, the idea of being able to kind of see a fuller spectrum of who they could be than just their bad behavior?
Yeah, it's a great question.
Thanks, Nick.
those are my favorite, to be honest. I mean, throughout my career as an educator, it was I often would request the quote unquote troublemakers, like the difficult ones to deal with, so to speak, for exactly that reason. Like, it's in my opinion, not all that difficult to just get a, let's say, naturally academically intelligent person to do well, right? To just learn and take the tests and jump through the hoops and those sorts of things. But the ones who don't fit that mold and who really need somebody to lean on, those are the fun ones to work with to me. I mean, they're all fun to work with, but those are kind of the special cases. How do you go about doing that in a coaching situation? I think, again, it comes back to personalization. It's a lot of one-on-one time or small group time. It's helping them see their strengths and their talents, right? Not only those things, but certainly those things, and having a strengths focus to combat an experience and a system that often makes them feel like they're mostly made up of weaknesses.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's a really hard thing for anyone to sustain and navigate, let alone a person who's 12, 15, 17, those sorts of things. Helping them to really reflect on and clarify and think about what they want. You know, I'm going to say out of life, that's a big question for a teenager, but at least getting them like, okay, so maybe school isn't your thing, right? Right now, maybe a particular trajectory isn't your thing. That's okay. Like, you should give permission to yourself for that to be okay, but that doesn't mean do nothing, right? Who are you going to be, or what do you want to be, or what do you want to do instead of those things? And then once we can start to zero in on that, we can come back to what I said earlier, which is start to develop a plan, right? Okay, if this is the destination, what's the trajectory, right? What's the path, right? And that's not always super clear, but at least it's a starting point for a young person.
Yeah, definitely. This notion of flourishing pops up a lot in your work. So what is flourishing, first of all? How do you conceptualize it? And then I just want to think through, like, what would it mean for students to flourish in an education context?
Yeah. To me, it's really kind of a synergistic combination of well-being, which itself it can be a complicated concept scientifically, right? But I'm just going to use it very generally.
Sure.
More often than not, feeling pretty good. That doesn't mean constantly. It doesn't mean a lack of so-called negative emotion, or what you and I would probably call unpleasant emotion. So it's a synergistic combination of well-being, and whether you want to call it high performance, optimal functioning. I like Carol Riff's language around environmental mastery, right?
Me too.
Yeah, you know, just developing these competencies that give you a sense of self-esteem, self-concept, self-efficacy, and allow you to, I think, start to access that word we mentioned earlier, which is mattering. Right? What's at the core of mattering? Well, I need to have an entity that I matter to, right? But why might I matter to them? I don't mean to be overly crass about it, but you serve some sort of utility, right? That might be love, affection, companionship, but it might be a skill set, right? Sort of a quote unquote traditionally hard skill set, so to speak, right? So in an educational context, that's where I think you get back into that balance of the individual and the community. It's one thing to know who you are, know what your strengths are, know what you're motivated by, what you're passionate about, and what you want to do. But if that doesn't have a context, an ecosystem, a community to exist in, you're not necessarily going to get the pleasant emotion that's associated with it, right? So I think it's really this kind of nice combination of me and we. Right, these me needs and these we needs, and finding ways for those to fit together.
Yeah, I love that you bring that in. I'm a really big fan of Isaac Prelutensky's research, and he's one of the ones in the positive psychology world who really is trying to think through how these things combine to influence our sense of our need to matter, or influence our sense of our mattering. Yeah, no, I love that you do that. The me and the we, yes.
Yeah.
It's not all about helping students self-actualize independent of their environment.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Can you even self-actualize independent of your environment? Is that even possible? Yeah. Is that possible?
I was just going to ask that, right? Like, I tell people all the time, my opinion is you don't flourish in a vacuum.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you can look at simple things, whether it's emotional contagion, Pygmalion effect, right? We're starting to understand this more and more on a biological level as well. But obviously, our surroundings matter, our relationships matter. Right. So to suggest that we're just doing this in complete isolation seems to me to be a bit of a denial of reality.
Yeah. To even push that metaphor a little bit further, all you do in a vacuum is collect dust.
There you go. Love it.
So no one ever takes that metaphor like a little bit further. You know, yeah. I'll be the one to do that. You don't flourish in a vacuum. You just collect dust. Okay. Yeah. Okay. This is my sense of humor. Okay. So what are some of your greatest rewards that come from teaching? You know, why make this this part of your life's mission?
Mattering.
Really?
Yeah.
So we really have kind of hit, you know, coincidentally on some of the core things for you.
100%. Cool. I mean, listen, like I don't know anyone in the educational space who has said like, yeah, I got in it for the money or, you know, the stress or candidly. And I want to be very clear here when we talk about, you know, we and what people are doing and what's happening in classrooms. I don't want to put that on teachers because I think teachers have candidly some really unrealistic expectations in a lot of cases. They have a ton on their plates and a lot of stuff overflows off of that plate as a consequence. When it comes to good educators, the best educators, and the type of educator that I have always wanted to be, and to a certain extent continue to want to be, even though I'm working with some other populations now, it comes down to contributing, right? Having an impact. Now, that could be directly, right, to a young person, or it could be more indirectly to the young person who then is going to go out and impact society or their family or their community or whatever it might be, whatever nested level, you know, you want to think about. Ultimately, I think that's why you're interested in this too. Like, I still believe that education is the way to transform an entire society.
Yeah.
Right. I don't think we're doing that at this moment, but I still believe in the system. And so when I was, it must have been sixth grade. I was probably about 12 years old. I distinctly remember taking my sister, I have two younger sisters, took the youngest one out into the driveway. She had a soccer game that day. And I remember helping her with a couple of things. And she went out to the game later that day, had a great game, you know, big smile on her face, like really took it to this boy that was, you know, twice her size, that sort of thing. And I remember thinking, oh, I did that. Right? Like, not terribly humbly and certainly naively, but I remember thinking, well, the correlation is I worked with her. She went out and had this great game. Right, she's happy about it. That makes me feel good.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and so that feeling I grabbed onto, and then it was a 3 years later, I did a day at work sort of thing through my high school with my uncle, who's an incredible guy. And he was an athletic director at the time. And I remember leaving a school where I had a bunch of great relationships with my teachers, awesome teachers, you know, but just actually better people, people who looked out for me and felt kind of like friends, right? And going to work with my uncle and seeing him on the other side of that. Same relationships, right? But he was on the adult side. And I had that same feeling. I was like, oh, I want more of that. That's the way to get that same feeling I had with my sister time and time and time again. So what do I want to do? I want to go into education, right? So when you ask about meaning, mattering, purpose, ultimately it boils down to trying to work with someone, more often than not young people, who need a little bit of help, support, guidance, a friend, whatever it might be. It's just adding value. It's just impacting them positively so that they can go be a better version of themselves and ideally impact other people positively.
Yeah. Well, you're a good person.
I don't know about that, but
not everyone's motivated to do that.
I am fortunate enough to have those experiences early on and have them supported by family and friends who I think, you know, a lot of educators believe in education and believe in the potential of education. So I got, you know, it doesn't happen in a vacuum. I got lucky.
I love that I said you're a good person. You're like, I don't know about that.
Depends on who you ask, I guess.
I love that you, that's what you responded. You're like, I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't go that far. No, I mean, it's a beautiful pro-social motivation. I mean, not everyone has pro-social motivations. So, there's like correct. You got to at least give that to yourself. So there is this field that's popped up in the past couple of years. They're calling themselves the field of positive education.
Yeah.
I was wondering, how involved are you in that field? Do you go to the conferences? Do you know the main players in that field? And then what is the current state of the field? Because I can't say I've kept up too much with it.
So the background here is that I mentioned that story about meeting Tal Ben Shahar, right? And after that visit to my former school in Los Angeles, the school kind of said, hey, we want to do more of this. This sounds great. Why wouldn't we focus on well-being and the good life for our young people, right? And there's so much potential to be had here. And then I was kind of sitting here mid-dissertation saying, okay, cool, let me run with it. I've been at that school about a decade. I think had some credibility and respect and clout enough to kind of push that thing forward. And so I, within a year or so, became kind of the director of that program. That opened me up to the world of, for lack of a better phrase, although we'll talk about this in maybe in a couple minutes, positive education. And we started offering student electives, which quickly became intensely popular, probably a variety of reasons for that. And then eventually started teaching the parents and the alumni who were really interested in it as well. That got us to a point where I was starting to ask questions more so about the ecosystem around us. So for instance, you know, kid comes in to the elective and we talk about something like grit, because you mentioned Angela, or, you know, Carol's stuff around growth and fixed mindset, but then they go home and they get a completely different message. Or they go to the next teacher and they get a completely different message, right? And it felt, this might not be a bad thing, but it felt a little like Sisyphus. And, you know, hey, are we really going to get to the top of this hill like I'd really like to, right? Which, remember, was the whole reason I went into my PhD program in the first place.
Yeah.
How do we get the best out of our young people, right? Yeah. And it quickly became apparent to me that that had to be an ecosystemic question on some level. So that led me to get connected with different organizations like IPEN, the International Positive Education Network. They wanted to get involved with our school. We had a variety of different plans. And suffice to say, at some point early on in the pandemic, we went through some transitions, and it became clear to me that part of the ecosystemic question has to involve my colleagues. And it became clear that colleague well-being might not be of the utmost priority. And to be candidly, Scott, I didn't want to be the jackass walking around talking about positive psych and well-being with a bunch of people who are miserable. That was of no interest to me, right? So fortuitously, within the same week of sort of having that insight, or at least judgment, I connected with my co-director of human flourishing at the Shipley School, right, which is right down the road from where you're from. And I had reached out to her. Her name's Dr. Sharon Russell. Shout out to Sharon. She's awesome. I had reached out to her because we were seeking essentially a counselor, a counseling position at the school in Los Angeles. And she responded to me and said, well, we're seeking an associate director of positive education, which is what it was called at the time. And so I called her the next day and said, hey, how about me? We knew each other a little bit already. She was a little surprised that I was considering moving, but I knew Shipley, I knew its reputation, and it's a long way of answering the question, but we're going to get there.
It's okay. Take your time.
So my wife and I picked up, moved to Philadelphia, because the Shipley School, where I now still do consulting and in that co-director position, this is a school where a lot of notable psychologists, I'll leave names out just for privacy, but people that a lot of people would know, they send their kids to Shipley because of the emphasis. You can call it pause psych, you can call it human flourishing, well-being, whatever it might be, but I think we at Shipley are at least aspiring to do things a bit differently. And so coming from my school in Los Angeles, I thought this would be a really great opportunity to get even more embedded in this field, right? Yeah. So to answer your question, yes, through my work in LA, through my work with the Shipley School, I've had the opportunity to kind of collaborate with or be in meetings with the likes of Angela and Marty Seligman and others who are really, really big names in that field. As well as attend some of these conferences, get exposed to some of these other leaders like Lee Waters and others. And so to a certain... yeah, to a certain extent, embedded in it, and at the same time, critical of it. I don't mean to be overly derogatory about it. Yeah, somewhat. I mean, here's why I keep changing language. I'll give you another side note. So a friend of yours, who I told you I met in LA because we had her out for a talk, Sonia Lear-Bormirsky, right? She came and gave a talk at my school in Los Angeles, and we talked a little bit about the name positive psychology. Mm. I haven't met a person that's a big fan of it. That title, right? And a lot of the reason why, you know, we had Todd Kashdan on our podcast, I know you know Todd, is the shadow side, right? The upside of your dark side, the way unpleasant or so-called, you know, negative emotions are actually associated with like different markers of psychological health and well-being and keep us safe and keep us motivated and these sorts of things. Oftentimes it gets confused with toxic positivity. Oftentimes it gets criticized, somewhat fairly so, for being a little too individualistic, right? And not having enough of a community focus. And so pretty quickly into my tenure at Shipley, Sharon and I started talking about whether positive psychology or positive education was really the term that we were going for, not only because we had some concerns about it, but I mean, to be crass, from a marketing perspective, that sounds a little hand wavy. As well, right? When you're trying to essentially recruit families. So, you know, there's been an evolution from sort of, you know, the kids in front of me are not all becoming their best selves to, oh, is it a motivation question? Is it a flow question? Is it a well-being question? Is it a purpose question? To, well, it's all of that. How do we help them like collect this recipe, so to speak, right? Which you've done really nicely in Transcend, and then start reorganizing and rethinking systems to make sure that that can happen.
I love that. And I love that you said systems. Peggy Kern in Australia is doing great work on applying a systems way of thinking to education. You talked about the label. It's a shame when a label can detract or get in the way of what we're trying to change, you know, fundamentally. It's just a distraction. It's not, we don't want to harp on a label in any way. You know, I don't want to label a student, right? I've referred to it, sort of my mission, and I want to see what you think of this label. And you can be honest with me. You can shatter my dreams too, if you want. Sure. But I like to call it, toward a human-centered education system. Yeah. And I was wondering what your thoughts on that. I was even thinking about maybe writing a book about that. And we've talked about this before.
We have talked about this. I love it. You know, when you came on to our podcast, we had a great, I think, conversation. I wouldn't go so far as calling it a debate, but we were kind of using different language. Are we talking about flourishing? Yeah. Are we talking about self-actualization, right? You can bring in different forms of well-being and life satisfaction.
Absolutely.
This is not going to sound super sciencey for coming from an academic, but I think we're mostly talking about the same stuff, right? I think actually recently you had a tweet or an IG post or something where you more or less said something along those lines. Like, we're mostly talking about the same stuff, and that stuff is what most human beings really need. I mean, truly need, right? So when you say the phrase human-centered education, I completely jive with that, and that's what I would like to see. I do not think that's anywhere close to what we currently have.
I agree. But I do want to give Shipley some credit, and you some credit, because you're moving in the right direction, I think. You know, can you tell me a little bit more how the Shipley School is attempting to help to lead a charge into whatever we want to call it?
Sure.
How's it moving in a direction we want education to be moving in, I guess is my question.
Sure. Yeah. Well, again, I mean, it's aspirational, right? Shipley has to exist in this ecosystem as well. So there's certain challenges that come with that to existing as an independent school. I will just, you know, respectfully push back and correct. It has very little to do with me. And I think we talked about this when you came on to our show. Honestly, my co-director, Sharon, deserves the overwhelming credit for moving a lot of these things forward. So Sharon is traditionally a counselor by trade, right? And comes with that sort of background, which is why I think she and I make a good team and always felt like we'd make a good team, because I was coming from the educator pos psych background, right? So there was a nice sort of, I think, complementary skill set there. So Sharon has been at Shipley, I can't even remember now, at least a couple of decades with one stint away in between. But when she came back, she really started to push forward what at that point I think was commonly referred to as social emotional or socio emotional learning.
Yeah.
Right? And that led to the development of our curriculum that's known as SEED, S-E-E-D, Social, Emotional, and Ethical Development. So at Shipley, every student takes SEED classes, I believe, K through 12 every year.
Wow.
Right. As one of their, it's called a quote unquote minor, which is essentially, it's not an elective because they can't opt in or out, right? But it's not graded. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
So that gives any Shipley student the opportunity to at least start to get exposed to some of these ideas and concepts and exercises and principles in a way that we hope gives them different capacities as they move on to that next stage in life. Right? Now, again, that's aspirational. My role in that is really to primarily focus on our adult population alongside that. So some of it is exactly what you said. Primarily what I do for Shipley now is work with the teaching population to help them understand where there are organic opportunities to include concepts like flow, emotional agility, gratitude, mindfulness, right? Any sort of the different tools and subcomponents you might think of as being highly associated with our field. Where are the opportunities for them to organically embed those into a classroom experience or out of classroom experience as well, right? Because they're teachers primarily in classroom experience, because many teachers are looking at the situation and saying, so I need to teach my core curriculum and all the skills associated with it. Now I need to teach well-being stuff. And by the way, and this is something Shipley's deeply committed to, but I need to be thinking about concerns of DE&I as well. And you can see how quickly a teacher's plate will start to overflow, right? Oh, yeah. So what I need to do at this point with Shipley and others is try to help them comprehend quickly and apply efficiently, right? Because there's just not a lot of space for teachers to do more.
Yeah, I agree. And then related to that question is the question you probably get all the time, which is what's the balance or tension between schools spending time on traditional academic skills and schools focusing on developing human potential? Because what if teachers focus so much on the students' happiness and self-actualization and all that fun stuff, and then they bomb and tank their standardized tests? Well, the school system's not going to be happy with that, right? The school administrators?
Right. So I think there's a couple things here, and it's a great question. I think you and I chatted about it a little bit over lunch in LA back in April, but
we did.
Listen, I'm not going to purport to have the answers. Okay? What I will say is it goes back to one of my original comments about not having universal approaches and standards for a wildly diverse population, not just nationally, right? But even within states, even within communities, right? So for instance, I have student taught and worked in schools that are really at the bottom of the socioeconomic spectrum. And I've spent most of my career working at schools that are at the top. Okay. In both circumstances, I would argue neither population of students is particularly happy or satisfied. I go back to the 2015 study. Mark Brackett mentions this in Permission to Feel, that noted, I think, 75% of the words that students use to describe their school experience are negative, right? It suggests something about unpleasant emotion, which is...
That's telling us something.
It's telling us something, right? The more interesting question is why? And in some cases, you have communities and environments in which teachers are, they're just trying to keep their head above water. Right, they're getting students who are years behind in reading levels. They're getting students who have really no emotional awareness or self-regulation, no math skills, science skills, writing skills, you know, whatever it might be. And so I'm very hesitant to say that we should ignore those things, because there is a practical utility to them. And I and you want to live in a country with an educated populace, right? For years, I taught a sociology class. My bachelor's degree is in history. So critical thinking and research and being able to analyze whether information is true, untrue, fact check, those sorts of things are important skills. At the same time, my years working in sort of the top end of the socioeconomic ladder, right, when it comes to schools, a lot of those students are dissatisfied, unhappy even, in part because that's all they're hearing and that's all they're getting, right? Take these classes, get these grades and these test scores to get into these schools. One of the schools I worked at, 60% of the population went to about 25 different schools.
Wow.
Right? That's it. Now, fine, those schools might be great and they might have a great experience, but the narrative there is that there's really kind of one path or one trajectory, in this case, to success, but the implicit right. message there is to the good life, mm-hmm. right? Like, why do we want success? Well, because we think it's going to lead to a good life. We're going to be satisfied, happy, whatever it might be. And so what you get into is this kind of vicious cycle of like, well, do the thing to be prepared for the next thing. And then do that thing to be prepared for the next thing. And I didn't see a ton of investment into who the individual was, making sure they can explore their interests and their curiosities, right? Like it was, so I mentioned the elective I taught.
Yeah.
Probably about half of the school took that from year to year, but the other half that didn't, right? They basically could not. Once they became juniors or seniors, because their perception was, I got to do the honors track, I got to do the AP track, I got to do stuff that gives me a 5-point grading scale, and positive psychology does not. So even though it might be great for me, it might help my well-being, my motivation, my sense of self, whatever it might be, I cannot risk not getting the test score or not getting the grade that's going to get me into this school and supposedly unlock the rest of my future, right?
That's so the culture.
It's the culture, right? And that's why I keep saying system and the culture and the larger ecosystem, because both ends of the spectrum are dealing with really different pressures and different challenges. But in both cases, it's leading to a lot of underwhelm, unhappiness, apathy, amotivation. You know, you can go on and on.
It's sad.
It's terribly sad.
I mean, I'm upset right now.
It's brutal. Scott, I mean, to be very transparent with you, this is part of why I've moved in different directions in terms of coaching and consulting and then launching this program for young athletes, because I'm now starting to find ways where I can work outside the system, right? Or around the, like, how do you get this to young people in ways that are a little bit more organic and in environments where they actually want it and they crave it, rather than just trying to jam it into an already overcrowded system that has different values and different priorities.
Yeah. So look, I'm glad that you're highlighting that a big part of the problem is the system and the culture. So I'm really glad you brought that up. Have you drawn on any of my work at all?
In any 100%.
I say that with a little bit shyly, but has any of my own ideas about education and the culture and how we, our human potential, need to think about differently, has it brought into your work at all?
Oh, 100%. So I don't know if you and I ever talked about this, but like when I moved to Philly, so this was like 2 or 3 months before you and I met, that's when I read Transcend. And I already knew about you through a variety of different things, probably some of those pause ed conferences back when you were at Penn and still doing some of that work. I know you're still doing some of that work, but you're a little more embedded, I think, in that world at that point. Yeah. And so like when we first met, like I pretty much had a fanboy moment. It's like, holy shit, Scott Barry Kaufman, right? In the same virtual room as me, right? So yeah. I had been aware of your work. I had always really enjoyed your work. And at the same time, your book on creativity, Wired to Create, and Ungifted were tremendous for me in a variety of ways, but Transcend really took it home, right? That was where, especially as an academic in some ways, which I sort of fashion myself to be, there was so much good science, so many good references and citations and talking about trajectories and different nuances, because you're a nuanced guy. So we actually, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but at Shipley, when we started moving beyond this idea of just positive psychology, you mentioned Peggy Kern. we had been using the PERMA model for flourishing, right? Which has a bunch of really wonderful things about it.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of people who would maybe push back against it, right? The Human Flourishing Program at Harvard, who sponsors our podcast, has a different model. We mentioned Carol Riff, different model. You would not call your sailboat metaphor a metaphor for flourishing, but it speaks to a lot of the same things, and it's a different model at the same time, right? So I mentioned Sharon, this is a credit to her. What she did was started taking some of these different models, putting them side by side, and then we kind of said, all right, where's the synthesis? Like, where can we pretty confidently say these are the things that matter to most people across the lifespan? And then how do we start to really deeply embed them, not just in classrooms, but in the ecosystem of a school or a community that includes the parent group and includes alumni more holistically? So it's a long way of saying, yeah, your work is literally embedded in the work that we do together.
That's awesome. Yeah, I just really am passionate about getting the word out about all these human needs that are being unaddressed in the education system. So I can't help it when I talk to educators, but be like, you know, have you considered like the need for exploration? You know, where's that? Where's that in the school system? Where's the need for love?
Yep. 100%. 100%. So we just had an episode. So I've mentioned a couple of times, we have this podcast, Flourish FM. You were nice enough to be a guest on it. So today we released an episode with a professor at Cal State San Fran, who founded and runs a school in East Oakland called the Roses and Concrete School. And the whole premise, especially in East Oakland, is trying to focus on the material core human needs of young people in an environment where those things are often not present, or at least insecure, right?
Yeah.
So it's a focus on well-being from the foundation up. So it's interesting that we're talking about this, because I think more and more schools are starting to figure out, we got to do it differently. We got to focus on exactly the sort of stuff you and I are talking about here.
Yes. Well, that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. Tell me more about this podcast that you co-host with Dr. John Beal. And sure. What does the FM mean? Is there a significance to that?
Yeah, great question. So what happened was we approached, so John and I, my colleague, Dr. John Beal, who's traditionally a philosopher, but really focuses on human flourishing and also works in schools. He approached me and said, hey, what do you think about starting this podcast and approaching the folks at the Human Flourishing Program at Harvard and the Department of Education at Oxford and Shipley to support us and sponsor us? And the whole premise is deep diving into the science of human flourishing. I say the as if it's this like tight boundary and kind of settled category, but we treat it, I think, rather broadly. It could be a traditional kind of positive psychologist, somebody like Lee Waters, but it was somebody like yourself, right, who focuses on self-actualization, humanistic psychology. We have already had educators, we've had philosophers, we've had people who write about critical thinking and technology. And it is supposed to be a deep dive into high quality, hard science that helps people understand the components of a flourishing life and ideally, practically, how to build those different components. Now, the key piece here, and I'm glad you asked about the FM, is one of the things that we wanted to do and that Harvard was very much in agreement on is to get this outside of the podcast space, to get it into other countries, other parts of the world that very often do not have access to these teachings, learnings, these podcasts, but they do have access to radio, right? And so the FM is aspirational and a reminder that eventually, if we're fortunate enough to grow this thing and really develop it, then eventually what we'd like to do is to get it into some of these parts of the world on radio so that it's more accessible for more people. And that's accompanied by, I think, an emphasis on having a diverse set of guests, different cultural influences, maybe different spiritual influences, and really trying to make sure that we represent this in a holistic, diverse way. Because, you know, let's be candid about it. John and I are a couple of 30-something white dudes from the U.S. like trying to share this. And so we really are intentional about bringing in guests who will bring some of those diverse perspectives as long as they're still research-based.
I love that. Yo, I am so proud of what you guys are doing over there.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
So important and so necessary.
That means a lot coming from you.
Yeah. Well, I mean it. And it was an honor being on your show. Let me ask kind of a last question here, because you're interested in working on ways to help bring flourishing young people, not just inside the classroom, but if I understand correctly, you're also trying to help them to flourish outside of the classroom. It doesn't all just matter inside the classroom, right?
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? And I think that'd be a nice way to kind of end this conversation today.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I'm working on at this moment is, I guess you could almost kind of call it a bit of a Trojan horse. Not the perfect analogy, but I think part of what I've seen and the trouble you run into is when you try to incorporate these things into classrooms, you run into a few different problems. Number one, I mentioned earlier, if you're doing it with other teachers or asking other teachers to do it, they don't have the time, the space, the understanding. Often they don't have the skill set. Number two, so then if you offer it as its own course, if it's not graded, the sad reality is it gets deprioritized by the students, right? Mm. The next level is if it is then required. I mean, you've been around enough teenagers, right? Like that drive for autonomy at that age, anything they are forced to do more often than not becomes the enemy. Mm. Right? Rationally or irrationally, it becomes the enemy. So when I say Trojan horse, what we're trying to do right now is get people the material through avenues and fields that they're already interested in or hooked on. And so what that means for me traditionally is athletics. So I have partnered with, I think you met him once or twice, a former colleague of mine, Dr. Adam Wright, who's the director of mental performance for the Washington Nationals. And a tremendous coach, a lot of clinical background, right? Amazing psychologist in a variety of ways. And then I'm bringing in a lot of the educational piece. And we're working hard. Right now I'm working with a Division I soccer program here in Michigan where I'm currently sitting and trying to figure out how we can create reasonably priced, right, concise, effective programming, so asynchronous learning along with maybe group coaching, individual coaching, to ultimately get this material to as many young athletes as possible. Just in the last few months, 5 or 6, I think, D1 athletes committed suicide. There's over half of Division I athletes, and this is just college, right? Experience some sort of mental illness or just have trouble navigating the you know, kind of general ebbs and flows of life. But it's also the high school athletes, and it's also young professional athletes. I've worked with a few who frankly, I mean, if I were to be simplistic about it, they've got all the talent in the world, but they're anxious, they're stressed, they're in their own head, they have negative self-talk, they're unhappy, all the different things that can come with it, right? So Adam and I are trying to combat those trends and get this material to people who are asking for it instead of getting it to people who are basically being forced into it.
Oh man, I love that so much. That means the name of the game. The name of the game is to light the fire from within.
That's right. So yeah, so we call it the anti-fragile athlete. People can check it out. It's really kind of drawing this distinction between being fragile, resilient, anti-fragile. Obviously a nod to the original work there. And trying to find different partners, right? Different athletes that want to learn and want to get this out there.
I love it. Oh my gosh. I'm so glad that we were able to get this in the can. Nick Holton on the Psychology Podcast. It has been so much fun chatting with you. And we got to keep up this discussion, how we can change the education system.
I would love to. Maybe there's a part two at some point, but I just want to thank you, Scott. Yeah. Obviously, I told the story. I've been a big fan of yours for a while. I've been a huge fan of the show for a long time. So Thanks, Nick, to now be on it on the other side is a real treat for me.
I love it. Can't wait to get this out there. Thanks, cool. Nick.
Yep. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.